Now a no-no. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
Reporting by remote, I'm David Byrd.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and our moderator is Shayna Istulin, Political and Foreign Affairs Correspondent.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. COVID crisis in the U.S. Virus numbers hit new records as the Trump administration pushes for schools to reopen in the fall. Millions are still out of work. We'll look at what Congress can do to stabilize the economy. And the president doubles down on stirring racial division ahead of the 2020 election. Josh, JJ, I'm excited to talk to you. We have so much to discuss, but I want to start with coronavirus. As of this conversation, worldwide, there have now been 12 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, over 500,000 deaths. And here in the U.S., which has the highest count of cases and deaths, we have now passed 3 million cases and more than 130,000 Americans have died in just 5 months, which is an astounding number. We had this brief lull, JJ, but now we're seeing numbers rising in most states in this country. Can you give us a broader view of what we're seeing and where the hotspots are?
Well, one of the things, and it's good to be on with all of you, one of the things that I have seen as recently as this morning is this idea that some people are actually trying to weaponize COVID-19 to use it for their benefit. A good example of what I'm talking about is go to any state in the U.S. and talk to almost any police force in any jurisdiction, and you will find frustrated police officers there who have been told or confronted by criminals who will tell them, listen, I know that you don't want to be around me because I have or may have COVID-19. I know that certain jails are letting people out early because of COVID-19. And this has empowered a lot of criminals to do things that break the law because they know they won't be dealt with. And along those same lines, and not in a criminal capacity, but you have a lot of people who still, regardless of all of the overwhelming evidence that this is a deadly pandemic, perhaps the most deadly ever, they still are more interested in their own personal wishes. And this is a part of the problem that's driving these numbers. The other part of this issue is the inability, it seems, for the U.S. to get on the same page, whether it's, you know, the government and the medical community or the medical community and the politicians, et cetera. Those are some very big issues that are troubling, and it's a very serious national security threat, whether people want to see it that way or not.
That's really interesting. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in what you said, especially about the criminal aspect, because you do have criminal justice reform folks who are like happy that people are being let out of prison. But on the other hand, as you mentioned, criminals are using it to their advantage. And then mixed messaging coming from the top, especially about masks. You have some states not mandating masks. You have now some states like Texas who are more in favor of masks. But I wonder, Josh, and especially because you cover this from more of a global perspective, the U.S. is still arguably the global superpower, certainly the world's biggest economy. If the virus keeps spinning out of control and the economy keeps limping along because of it, what does it do to the rest of the world's economic recovery?
It's very unfortunate to see how the duration of the virus here, but perhaps not entirely surprising, partly because there's been such a push to reopen the economy. That's part of the reason that we're seeing this continued surge in virus cases. I have a slightly different perspective on this. I mean, I obviously focused a lot on what happens in Europe as well. And I think if you look at the per capita deaths, for example, the US is still behind much of Western Europe, behind the UK, behind Spain, behind France. This is a very big, sprawling, diverse country. So while coronavirus ripped through New York and Washington State and New Jersey and Connecticut, it didn't hit the Sun Belt. We hoped it might never really hit the Sun Belt too hard. Unfortunately, it has. So now we're seeing Arizona, Texas, Florida really struggling. But unfortunately, I think given the way that the virus was seeded here, this is just a very likely outcome in a country of this size and diversity that wants to get its economy running again. I think Americans sometimes can be a little bit too focused on what's going on here and not look at the bigger picture. Comparable countries where it was seeded in a comparable way had far more deaths so far than America. So there's a long way to go on this.
Are you accusing Americans of only focusing on themselves? That's shocking to me. But it is true that you are seeing, it makes sense that people are focusing on what's happening in the US because it's what's happening around them. And it is true, according to Johns Hopkins, the UK is number one, or as you said, towards the top. European per capita death rate is very high, higher than the United States. The president is now tweeting that the US has the lowest mortality rate. That is not accurate. We're in the middle. But what's interesting, JJ, is when you look at the death rate in the United States, I mean, every single death is a tragedy. But compared to what we saw in April and May, the numbers of people dying are not as high. Should Americans be somewhat encouraged by those numbers?
Absolutely not. And here's why. Because it is the trajectory of getting to where the experts say we're going to go if we don't change our behavior. That should be the thing we are really focusing on. There are still people out there that still have not gotten that they can die. It's not just elderly people. It can be young people. It doesn't matter what your income level is. I mean, there is the president of Brazil who's now contracted the coronavirus. This is not at all any consolation to these numbers right now based on what we were seeing before. What is good from a security perspective, looking at how people have a blueprint to move forward on in terms of accessing PPE or personal protective equipment and ventilators, and people now know what to do and what to expect. But, you know, all of these places that have relaxed rules and tried to reopen a little too soon, that's essentially put us back into a really difficult position. And we probably should keep in mind that it takes a while for these cases to show up. And a lot of people who have it don't know they have it. And we know some people now who've had it before with devastating consequences and survived. Some of them are getting it a second time. So this is the thing that we really need to be concerned about. We really don't know much at all about this virus.
We don't know much at all. But as you mentioned, we do know some ways of treating it better, which might be contributing to lower amounts of people dying. And you look at a case like in Florida, where the governor does seem to be downplaying the surge in that state. He's pointing out that it's mostly young people that are getting it and they have more complicated consequences from the virus. But as JJ pointed out, they can also spread it to older people, people who have underlying conditions. The Republican convention is supposed to be in Jacksonville, Florida next month, Josh. The president told VOA this week that he seems to be more flexible about what the convention will look like. We know the president wanted this big party packed convention. So what does that tell you, that the president seems to be shifting on that?
I think it tells you that Ron DeSantis and other Florida officials were pretty clear about what was possible in Jacksonville. And we know the president wanted to have his big coronation ahead of November's election, but there is some reality that he has to face, and that's the political and medical consequences of having a typical party convention are just unthinkable at this point when you look at the scale of the outbreak in Florida. So for all us political hacks who were planning the big moment of the cycle to be those conventions, well, that's just not going to happen. They're going to be very different affairs, mostly remote, thinly attended, and so forth.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if masks are actually worn at the Republican convention. Let's move on to this issue of schools, because the Trump administration has been putting a lot of pressure on schools to reopen in the fall. I know a lot of stressed parents who want to send their kids back. You also have pediatricians warning of long-term consequences. Kids don't go back to school. But how do you weigh that against people possibly getting sicker now because you have schools reopening?
There is no, from my perspective, there is no greater priority than the health and safety and security of people. There are ways to teach without being in person, in place, in a central location for the time being. And one of the things that was clear to me early on, albeit a bit painful at the time, was the need for me to be patient. And I think that may be something that some of the other folks around the country, you know, may want to think about, especially some of our political leaders, is that patience can go a long way towards saving us from creating even greater tragedies. Because I think what we've found ourselves in now are some self-inflicted parts of this situation because we tried to do things too quickly. This has been a season of waiting. It's been a season of taking time to think carefully about where we go next, and sending children back to school too soon. I mean, that could be devastating for children and even more so for families.
And for teachers who may be older and more vulnerable. But of course,
yes.
You're asking patience from parents who really want to send their kids back to school. But Josh, I want to look at higher education, because the Trump administration this week announced they'll be stripping visas for foreign students who are enrolled at universities where courses are done entirely online. So you have Harvard and MIT. They're now both suing to stop this. Is this something that's realistic, or is just going to get tied up in court? How are you reading the situation?
Yeah, well, this strikes me as a classic Trump administration gambit that is somewhat shocking and will definitely end up mired in legal complications. Nonetheless, it does rather shed light on this quite stark situation where a university like Harvard is asking its students to pay $50,000 a year to take a Zoom course. Someone joked to me this week that if the Harvard students are as smart as we think they are, they'll probably just all defer, because that's not what you pay for. You know, you don't just pay for the stamp and the brand. You pay for the experience of being there. It really does question whether, you know, the model of higher university education can work under these circumstances in America. I thought that Harvard decision was quite premature for the whole of next year. I mean, we just don't know where we're going to be. As you've mentioned, young people don't suffer from this in anything like the way that old people do. Might there not be some middle ground Harvard could find to try and provide its students with experiences? It all feels a little bit premature to me, but we'll see where it goes in court. But if I was a student, I'd feel absolutely devastated about losing my college experience in that way.
Especially if your parents or you are paying $50,000. But JJ, you know, what's really interesting about this whole conversation is that higher education in the U.S. is really a form of soft power. It's a way that the U.S. can bring in all these foreign students, the best and the brightest, and introduce them to American culture. If the Trump administration is starting to kick students out, or you have fewer students coming because they're afraid of getting COVID-19 here in the U.S., what does that do to that soft power tool that the U.S. has?
Well, essentially, it renders it useless. But I think one of the things that probably should be taken into consideration with this whole situation of the education piece and people from other countries and the way that they plug into our economy and our system here in the U.S. and how we all want to proceed and progress as a world, I think it's important to remember that this is not something that's just a COVID-19 issue. This is also something that has to do with intelligence and national security right now. Specifically, when you start thinking about the impact of people coming from other places, coming here, possibly getting sick, and then, you know, going back home if they, you know, choose to do so, that's a problem for the U.S. in that country. That's a problem for the pipeline of people who want to come here to get a good education in a safe and healthy place. The other side of the coin is people coming from other places. Again, you know, we just don't know how this works. We don't know enough about it to know how it's going to work in the long term. We know people get sick and get well, but then there are other consequences that come along later that affect the brain, the respiratory system, even the cardiovascular system. So there's just so many things we don't know about this. So it really warrants being very careful about how we deal, not just with ourselves here in the U.S., but also with others, and not just from a purely selfish economic or our image point of view, but from a health and security point of view, for the benefit of those who want to come here.
No, it's a really good point. I mean, I think you could also just argue that we don't know is the theme of the conversation in this era of coronavirus. Let's take a break, and we're going to continue on the other side.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. And our moderator, Shayna Istulin, Political and Foreign Affairs Correspondent.
Welcome back, J.J. Josh. I want to just briefly touch on the U.S. pulling out of the WHO, the U.N. agency that's tasked with global public health. Josh, the president has been threatening to do this for a while. So what happened now? Why has the U.S. pulled out of the WHO?
Well, they're still not fully out of it, but they submitted their official documents to withdraw this week. This is something the president has wanted to do really since the pandemic began. He has sought to blame the WHO for some of its missteps early on, which were significant in terms of not holding China to account, in terms of taking the Chinese word for it about transmission of the disease, all of which were crucial mistakes in those early weeks and meant that the whole world's response was somewhat debilitated. So Trump doesn't like these multinational organizations. He doesn't like that the Chinese have gained a lot of influence at the WHO. And he's decided that rather than push back and push to increase American influence at the organization, he'd rather just withdraw. And America is the primary funder of the WHO by some distance. It does both mandatory and voluntary funding for the World Health Organization. So this is a process. It takes a while. The mandatory funding is congressional. That could be quite hard for him to withdraw. The voluntary funding is easier. He will probably pursue this. He's developed a real grudge against the organization. This is one of those things, one of many things that really will be decided, I think, in November's election. If Joe Biden becomes president, he'll undoubtedly reverse this immediately. And this process won't be completed by then. So in a way, it's one more thing that's on the ballot in November.
Although I'm not sure that many Americans know exactly what the WHO is or will be voting based on that. But you are correct that the Democrats will probably push back against the president withdrawing. JJ, the president has got criticism for this, that he's pulling out of the WHO because he wants to distract from his own missteps. But as Josh pointed out, there are real criticisms of the WHO, how they responded in the early days, that they were too cozy to China. Leaders there praised China for being transparent, even though we know China was silencing whistleblowers in the early weeks. But if the U.S. pulls out, then they cannot reform from within. So what is the U.S. gain?
You make a great point. The U.S. leaving WHO leaves a void there. And that void is exactly what the Chinese government would take advantage of to manipulate and to do whatever is most expedient and of greatest interest to the Chinese government, most likely. And this is a problem for a couple of different reasons. The U.S. benefits greatly from being the principal investor in the WHO that included almost $1 billion from 2016 to 2017. But, you know, the image of the U.S. as a world leader is something that has been suffering greatly for the last few years. A lot of people haven't really embraced what that means. And when you look at it actually from a geopolitical point of view, the U.S. pulled out of Syria against the advice of Defense Secretary Mattis, and he actually quit his job because of that. Mm-hmm. Who stepped in? Of course, Russia did. That's precisely what the Russian government wanted to do. So the ability of the U.S. to be a global leader would be diminished quite significantly by pulling out of WHO. The other thing I would point out, the U.S. has made similar threats when it comes to pulling out of global organizations like NATO. You know, this is the thing about this whole process. Why is the U.S. doing this? That leads to an erosion of trust in the U.S., not just in the president, but in the people who make up the apparatus that actually makes the U.S. work on a global scale. So it's not just a matter of this organization that deals with health, but it's the greater efficacy of the U.S. as a nation. It essentially would significantly diminish its ability to get its work done because it's just yet another scenario where the U.S. is stepping away from a global leadership role.
Yeah, and it's not just threats. I mean, the president has pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and it's what he campaigned on and what his base likes for all the criticism. I want to talk about the economy for a moment again. I want to dig down because you're seeing this massive economic fallout. Yes, June had nearly 5 million people going back to work, but we are really in this massive hole still. Congress is in recess. There's talk now about another stimulus package. Josh, what are you hearing that's being proposed that could actually pass?
There are about really three things that Congress needs to decide. It needs to decide on whether it's going to issue another stimulus check. It needs to decide on whether it will continue with enhanced unemployment bonuses. And then there's also talk of a back to work check. What we do know is that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, is very skeptical about continuing enhanced unemployment bonuses. There's a lot of worry in conservative circles about paying people not to work and that actually you might end up slowing the economic recovery if you continue to pay people more to not to work than they might earn working. So given his power in Congress, I think we might expect there to be a bit of an issue on the unemployment bonus. The president has expressed support for another stimulus check. He wants to see the stock market bouncing going into November's election. So Americans may well expect another check in the post come August.
This might be the last stimulus package before the election, given lawmakers' schedule here. And I want to talk about the election for a moment. It's 4 months away. President Trump seems to have decided that the best strategy to win is to focus on stirring up racial division. We saw that in his speech over the 4th of July, where he attacked protesters. JJ, it was a strategy that won him 2016 when he went after Mexican immigrants. Is this a strategy that's going to work in 2020?
I have to admit that I am not the most astute political journalist. In fact, I don't do politics at all, but I do have a couple of observations that may help to answer your question. A lot of people are aware, Shayna, of what it is that's going on. A lot of people are aware of where both campaigns are, President Trump's campaign and the campaign of Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee. But a lot of people, especially since the cascade of events that have taken place since the death of George Floyd, a lot of people are very well aware of the fact that things are changing in this country. And I'll just be very brief about this. One of the things that's most important and most clear right now to me is that a lot of people have started to understand that systemic racism is built on the foundation of other destructive behaviors that are completely accepted in this country. And those things have to be dismantled. I mean, situations where you have people being devalued, they're humiliated in public. They are denied the ability to go places, to do things, to get jobs, to do certain things. There's, you know, favoritism. There are scenarios where people are essentially just minimized to a degree where it becomes a very overt and painful experience for them. So they're realizing all these symbols around us, all of these names and all these memories and all these people who have driven this whole idea of racism over many years have to go. And at the same time, what they're also realizing is that we have to stop some of these destructive behaviors as well that are accepted and form a foundation of racism. So I'm not sure how the president's campaign is going to come out using the strategy that he's used, but I do know this: people are well aware of the problems that the U.S. has with racism right now and are looking for change.
Yeah, the president doesn't seem as interested in this conversation about racism in the U.S. He seems to be more focused on this war against cancel culture. I think, Josh, you wrote about that in the Sunday Times. And, you know, if you talk to a lot of not only Republicans, but Democrats too, they don't really like this idea of cancel culture, that in a healthy liberal democracy, there should be more speech, not less. You just had this week over 100 writers and scholars, liberals among them, like Gloria Steinem, they signed this open letter against cancel culture and intolerance for opposing views. But isn't there a difference between being against shutting down speech and then you have the president seeming to support the Confederate flag? I mean, isn't there some room for nuance there?
It's important to distinguish between his speeches that he gave over the weekend, which weren't in support of the Confederacy, and then some of his tweeting and his other statements where he has objected to, he sought to defend the sort of Confederate symbols in various places. I thought the speech over the weekend was really interesting. It was like Trump's American creed. Some of it was actually very aspirational and ambitious. He talked about, you know, the American future, about Ella Fitzgerald, about Frank Sinatra, about, he sought to draw a distinction between American history and, you know, Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and then the radicals, the people who seek to undermine it in his view. I think that speech, it was divisive because a lot of people are actually supportive of some of the, you know, what the protesters want. But I thought it was politically quite effective because he launched a massive culture war and put himself on one side of it very clearly. Whether it works for him in November, who knows? There's so many different factors going into the election. But I thought the president's speech was rather effective. Where he's ineffective is when he then goes on Twitter and complains about, oh, degrading our Confederate history or whatever. And that's where he really crosses a line that I think is pretty damaging for him.
And it's the same president, the one who's giving the speeches, and the same president who's tweeting, seeming to be in support of the Confederate flag. That is all the time we have. Thank you to Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and JJ Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP, and the host of the Target USA podcast. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shayna Stulen. Thanks for listening.